Everybody, my name's Glenn Hill.
And I'm Jacob Meyer.
Welcome to another Tactical Tennis Podcast. And before we dive into the US Open, which lots of exciting and weird and wonderful things happening over there, I feel like we should touch briefly on Grigor Dimitrov's big victory.
I know, big victory for you, since you're the one who's been predicting him to have a breakout year.
Yeah, a little bit. So he plays Kyrgios in the final. And I know a lot of people ahead of that match were pretty certain that Kyrgios was going to have more than enough in the tank to take care of Dimitrov. But it ends up being a straight sets victory for Grigor, 6-3, 7-5. Kyrgios, by the way, obviously had an amazingly great tournament to make it through to that final.
So, now, let's be honest. Well, yeah, let's be honest with each other and, you know, whoever's listening. How much?
No, let's lie.
Other people do. How much do you think that match, from Kyrgios's perspective, came down to how much he had left in the tank?
No, I think. Look, I think that match is ironically a great matchup for Dimitrov. To me, it wasn't really about whether or not Kyrgios had the energy. I just felt like Dimitrov. The thing about it to me is that part of Dimitrov's problem, in fact, let's just be real, the bulk of Dimitrov's problem is decision making, specifically when it comes to shot selection on court and point construction. And one of the things that Kyrgios does to somebody like Dimitrov is take the thinking out of tennis, because Kyrgios has the weapons. He comes at you and he's not the kind of guy who's going to just grind you out and margin you into making the unforced errors. He's going to make his share of unforced errors. He's getting some unbelievable winners. But the thing is, Dimitrov's an amazingly good athlete. He moves very well. He defends very well. And he creates well when you make him. And so to me, this was a match where Kyrgios just by the very nature of the way he goes about playing, is going to make Dimitrov a better player than he normally is. Which is... not something that Kyrgios, Kyrgios doesn't normally do that to people. Kyrgios normally makes people look worse than they actually are, just because his game's a little bit funky. He does some unusual stuff, and he can just come up with so much power out of nowhere that he can make people look silly sometimes. But for Dimitrov, I think it's a really good matchup, and I wasn't really surprised by Dimitrov winning or the fact that it was straight sets. What's your take on it?
I hesitate here. My take on it really is that Nick, to me, wasn't quite ready to win a title that big. He hasn't been in that position before. And I think if he had played Grigor two rounds earlier, he would have won. And I don't think it has anything to do with fatigue. I think it has everything to do with that final. I think there were a dozen people you could have put on the other side of the net and he would have lost. I think the fact that it was Grigor means that Nick basically wasn't the favorite. I think for some people he was, because of, you know, beating Nadal and because of the way he'd been playing.
A lot of people are down on Dimitrov too, you know.
A lot of people, I guess, are down on Dimitrov. But, I mean, Dimitrov's had a very steady body of work. Like, he's obviously a... you know, let's say whatever. He's obviously a top 15 player. With all the injuries and all the stuff that's going on those tour, he's very clearly going to finish higher than that this year. This is his first Masters 1000 title. So it's not as if Grigor has loads of those in his trophy case, but he's very, very much been in much bigger situations and he's much more experienced and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But to me, it was really about how was Nick really going to go out there and play? And some of that is motivation. And some of that is occasion and pressure. And, you know, I mean, Nick's issues are mental and decision-making much more than they are physical. I think if Nick goes out there and plays his A game, I think he's going to beat Dimitrov almost every time.
I don't think it's that great of a matchup for Nick. Dimitrov is one of the few guys athletic enough to genuinely hang with him when he comes out and plays his A game. And again, I, you know, I think that Kyrgios takes the decision making out of Dimitrov's hands and really pushes him to play his best. And so I don't think there's a dozen guys you could put across the net in that final. I think Nick's going to beat a lot of people in that situation. This just wasn't a particularly good matchup.
Those are two separate things. I mean, there's, to me, I think for sure there's a lot of guys that could have beat him in that final. There's no doubt about it. I mean, he's just, look, he just hasn't been there before. Like, it's not like he's, I mean, Grigor's been into semis of slams and big occasions, and he's played on every big court, and he's been, you know, the marquee player time and time again. And in a real way, I mean, he honestly has had a lot more pressure on him than Nick has. I mean, Nick is this, you know, people view him as an absurd talent, but I mean, Grigor was supposed to be the next Roger Federer.
Right. Well, wouldn't you think, Ben, that him finally having his chance to grab a Masters title, that's not going to play a role and put a lot of pressure on Dimitrov?
Well, I think if it had been 5 years ago, it would have. And I think honestly, if we go back and look at his career, I mean, I haven't done this, but if we go back and look at some of his early finals, then he probably went through the same thing. Nick's just going through that now. And, you know, I think if Nick's at a 250, then he's going to win that final. I think he's at that level now. When it comes to, you know, big tournaments like Cincinnati, Miami, Indian Wells, the Slams, I mean, he's not the same player in a final as he is in a third or fourth round. That's the way it is. But that being said, I think you have to give credit to Dimitrov. I mean, he's been very steady. You know, he's put together, like I said, a consistent body of work over the years. But of late, I think the level that he's bringing is very consistent. Like, he's not playing, he's not having lots of up and downs. He's not playing terrible matches. He's not losing the guys that, you know, are great matchups for him that he shouldn't lose to. Like, he's pretty much bringing it within a small spectrum day in and day out. So, to me, it wasn't a surprise for him to walk away with that title.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, you know, to be honest with you, I mean, I feel like Dimitrov really has had a little bit of an up-down year. I mean, he was up in the hard courts, down over the clay, and, you know, now he's back on the hard and doing better again. But, you know, I think Nick tends to bring his better tennis towards the end of tournaments. You know, coming back to the whole mental state and the motivation that you mentioned, that I think when he starts to get to the point where titles are on the line, he is more motivated, he is more focused. And, you know, I just don't think this was him being overruled by the occasion. I just think this was a matchup. This is an X and O's thing. And I think it's not a matchup that favors Kyrgios at this juncture right now. But
I didn't say overwhelmed. I just said not at his best. It's not the same thing.
Well, regardless, I mean, you to me, you made it seem as though you think that he lost that match because it was a final, and I think he lost that match because he played Grigor Dimitrov. And that's two very different things. But, you know, we could argue about that all night and probably really actually could. But how about a quick shout out to David Ferrer and his great run in the tournament. And hell, the way he's played last couple of weeks leading into the US Open.
I mean, I love it.
Me too.
I hate to single anybody out, but if you do some research into his racket choices over the last 2 years, I'm pretty glad to see him into the right style racket and away from the wrong style racket.
Yeah, so I like the way you very pointedly use the word style there, because it's not really about the brand of racket per se, as it is just being in the right frame.
Yeah, so I mean, you can tell a big difference in his game. You can tell a difference in his confidence. I mean, I think I'm on the record at some point with this on saying that David Ferrer's got one of the most underrated inside-out forehands, like, ever.
We've talked about his forehand in the past. I don't think we've done so on the podcast previously, but yeah, no, his forehand's pretty big.
Well, the forehand's pretty good. And yeah, and that's the thing. I mean, for his size, I mean, he can camp out over there in the backhand corner and hit inside-out forehands as big as anybody. And for most of his career, he's been able to do it basically ad infinitum without missing.
Right.
And when he lost that ability, I think in search of more overall power in his game, I mean, he went from being a guy that was top five to being a guy in the 30s.
Yeah, so, he was the gatekeeper for a long time. I mean, like, if you wanted to crack at the Big Four, you had to go through him. And
he turned away a lot of people.
Yes, he did. He was very steady. There was a lot of no, you may nots in his career for several years there. But I mean, look, that was a great tournament for him in Cincinnati. You know, he comes through. Who did he play first round? I think it was Tipsarevic, and then he gets Kerner Busta straight. Then he beats TM 3-3, which that was an odd match from TM, I have to say too. But and then loses to Kyrgios in two breakers. So interesting to see what he does leading into the US Open. And hey, speaking of which, the US Open starts tomorrow.
Yeah, or today, depending on when the podcast gets up. But we're recording this tonight on Sunday night.
Well, yes, on Monday, on August 28th, 2017, US Open starts. And, I mean, look, there's kind of been somewhat of a nuclear bomb going off in the draw with the I can't even call it the last-second withdrawal of Andy Murray, because it's like the earliest possible withdrawal after the draw was done.
Pretty much, yeah. I'm actually recording this from the city, and I was here, and he was actually practicing well, and people did not see that coming.
It's a little bit of an odd situation, you know, given the fact that I was about to say he waited till the draw came out, but that made it sound like he was waiting till the draw came out and then made a decision. But I find it curious that he has had this amount of time off and has obviously been working to get well for the US Open, and yet it became as so much of a last minute / second decision that the draw comes out and then he withdraws.
Okay, so let me break down one scenario that can explain how this kind of thing works, okay? Because the problem is we don't have all the information about, say, Andy Murray in this case. But it's highly unlikely. Like, you can't convince anybody that knows him at all that he did anything less than try his absolute darndest in a very intelligent and logical way to be able to play for this tournament.
Sure.
And he didn't withdraw late. He's had time off at the behest of his doctors.
Right. Just to put that in context for people, he's not played a single ATP match since Wimbledon.
Right.
So quarterfinals of Wimbledon to Sam Querrey back in July, mid-July.
Right.
And that was the last match he played.
So he hasn't played matches on the tour, but also he's had time where he did not practice and he did not train, and he just was resting his body in a very like thorough way. Not, you know, some guys are like, oh yeah, I'm resting as in I'm not playing tournaments, but I'm training 3 or 4 hours every day. He's had actual rest, and he's probably gone through a couple of cycles of this. So he's had basically a rest period, I would guess over the last 3 to 4 weeks, after which he had to start incrementally ramping up his training. And basically, let's say, look at the last 2 weeks between when he pulled out, which would have been, Saturday or Friday?
Saturday.
Friday night?
Was it Saturday or Friday? Either way. I mean, it was just hours after the draw.
Yeah. So in any case, if you look at the last 2 weeks, what he was hoping to achieve, we would think, would be the ability to train at full speed, like match speed, for, let's just say, 5 or 6 or 7 days in a row, something that normally he'd be able to do all the time. And so if he had to take a couple of days off, and then train for, say, 4 or 5 days, and then he had to take a day off again to rest, and then he was just hoping to train hard for 5 days. And basically, then, if that's successful, he's going to play. Well, that's landing on the Friday or the Saturday before the tournament. So he had a choice where he could either withdraw ahead of time, but that would be giving up on what he thought was a very good chance that he was going to be able to play. I think he really believed, hey, I'm going to be good to go here. And it seems like he could have played the first round, but it seemed clear that he would not be able to play five, six, seven matches over the 2 week period and be able to perform at anything that basically is near the level that people pay money to come see him play.
Right. Well, so just to play a little bit of devil's advocate here and maybe to voice some of the frustration of people who I'm sure have paid money in the hopes of seeing him, you know, play in the final against Nadal or Federer, you know, is it not reasonable to think that maybe he might have figured that out, you know, 6 or 7 or 8 or 10 hours earlier before the draw got set, and then he absolutely decimated the bottom half? I'm just saying, like, the guy's been off for over a month, and he's waited basically a handful of hours too long, and in doing so had a massive impact on the way the tournament's going to play out.
Look,
without playing the tournament.
Look, his focus is going to be completely on getting healthy and getting strong and trying to win the tournament.
Oh, absolutely.
I mean, you got to remember, here's a guy who's looking at the other four or five guys in the top 12 in the world that have pulled out, and he's thinking, I can win this thing. Right? You know, he wants another U.S. Open title. This isn't Federer. He's not run out of room in his trophy case. He wants more slams.
I don't think Federer's run out of room either, just for the record.
He's just building more trophy cases.
Yeah,
it's okay.
He has $100 million.
He has enough money. It's fine. But, you know, I mean, look, I think that's not a terrible question. The truth is, if you look at what he was going through, if Murray had showed up and said, yeah, man, you know, my practices for the last 4 or 5 days have been really crappy and I just can't do it, then I think you would be right to say, well, you should have done it 12 hours earlier. But that's not what he said. What he has said and what he has stuck to and what, from what I can tell, seems to be the truth from other outside reporters is that his practices have been great, that he really felt like he was going to be able to do it, and that it wasn't until after he finished the last practice that things started to feel bad again, and it just became clear that, okay, you know, I can't go multiple days in a row. Like, I just, like, he's not tournament fit. Like, he can play one match, sure, and he'll just kill himself to do it, but he's not going to be ready to go the next day or a day after that.
Right. Again, but I'm just saying, you know, in the last month and even the last week or two, I mean,
so he could have made that call. He could have made the call earlier, but then we could give him a hard time and say, well, you're just giving up then, you know, on playing, and you shouldn't do that. You know, you should try harder.
Yeah, but given his motivation state, I think we all know that he wants to win. I don't think people would be sitting around saying, oh, geez, Andy, you quitter. You shouldn't have withdrawn so quickly. You should have waited till the last second. I think there's a lot more frustration. I mean, but I think there's significantly more frustration about the way things have played out, because if we look at the bottom half of the tournament now, I mean, the bottom half of the draw is genuinely somewhat decimated.
Look, the truth is, if you look at the way the draw goes, okay? Well, okay, so quick primer. The thing that is going to upset people the most is that Nadal and Federer are both on the top half. Okay, so they're clearly the favorites to win the tournament, but right now they're seeded number one and number three, and the number two seed, who was Andy Murray, is gone. So there is no number two seed anymore. So
right.
If Andy Murray had pulled out, say, a day ahead of time, then Rafa would be the number one seed on the top, and Federer would be the number two seed on the bottom, and we would all be predicting a Nadal versus Federer final, and everyone would be happy.
Well,
that hasn't happened.
Yeah, not everybody would be happy, but yeah, certainly that hasn't happened. So just to clarify for people, because a lot of people are probably a little bit confused and frustrated about how the draw is handled now. Once the draw has been officially released and posted, if somebody pulls out, in this case Andy Murray, the number two seed, there's actually rules in place about how they handle that situation. And in this case, what they do is take the number five seed and move him into the place where Andy Murray was, which in this case was Marin Cilic. So Marin Cilic is now playing Tennis Sandgren in the opening round at the absolute bottom of the draw. And then, you know, they move the 17 seed around. So basically they just reshuffle the seeds in that part of the draw. And this trickle-down effect keeps going until you get a lucky loser, who I think in this case was lucky loser Lucas Lacko. Say that 10 times fast. Don't actually do that. No. It's good. We can skip on the actual thing. But that's a mouthful. But so he actually got into the draft having lost in the last round of qualifying and is now playing Benoit Paire in his opening round. And that's kind of the end result. But when we look at this bottom half now, it is a little anemic, especially the bottom quarter, because Cilic is there and not sure about the veracity of this, but I've heard he's still not quite 100%. He's playing Tennis Sandgren. I mean, if we go up looking at people who, you know, realistically could make an impact, I mean, Ferrer could go reasonably deep given his form recently.
Ferrer's in good form, but
he's in that quarter.
Yep.
But it's a question, right? And then yep. I'm just searching for other people. You know, I mean, one of the other marquee matchups of this round is Almagro versus Johnson. And then like Songa tops out that quarter as the number eight seed. And then if we move to the quarter above it, which is still the same half, you know, we've got Sasha Zverev, and then there's just more big gaps. You know, Kevin Anderson's in there eventually. But yeah, it's a bit of an underwhelming half now.
And yeah, I mean, look, the real problem isn't Andy Murray and, you know, the timing of his withdrawal, but the fact that just we're missing so many guys in the top 12. And with Murray out, with Nishikori out, with Wawrinka out, with Raonic out,
sure, that has a big impact. I mean, yeah. Really what that's done is exaggerated the effect of Murray's decision. You know, if more of those guys, I think, had been in the draw, people would probably still be frustrated just because of the Federer and Nadal side of things and them being in the same half. But that bottom half of the draw would look a little more robust, and it doesn't.
Yeah, I mean, the thing that's interesting is if you go to the finals, someone from the bottom has to make the final. And really, that's the way the draws work.
Captain Obvious reporting for duty.
And really, I think the only people that would be, you know, not shocking, basically, would be Cilic, who's won the U.S. Open before. But everyone was shocked when he made the final the first time.
Yep.
Let's not forget that. And then Sasha Zverev, I think people can believe that because he's been one of the top five players on the tour for the last six months.
Hands down the favorite in that half of the draw now, I think.
And then what, you know, Sanga, because he's been close to that before.
Yeah, but come on, let's be real.
No, I think, look, I mean, I think Sanga's got a great shot to do it. I think people just won't be excited about it because it's not as if he's been he hasn't been like the Cinderella story of the ATP Tour of late.
Right. Well, I think some people would be excited about it if he got there beating, you know, Nadal or Federer and some of the other top players. You know, if he just gets there because, you know, he beats Kokkinakis in the fourth round and what, you know, that's going to be a little less exciting.
Kokkinakis is going to be dirty on these courts, man.
Oh, you know, I don't argue that, but I'm just talking about in terms of the fame factor. But let's just do a quick rundown. Let's have a look at each quarter really quickly. Start at the top and maybe make a couple of little predictions early on and see what we think is going to happen. Because we've got, you know, I think the opening part of the top half of the draw is pretty simple. I mean, I think Nadal is a shoe-in to get through to the third round at the very least, where he's likely to play Gasquet, which I think is a good matchup for Rafa. So he should be through to the fourth without any real problems.
I mean, Gasquet's never beaten him.
Yeah, it's just a bad matchup.
That would be the definition of a good matchup. I mean, you do have to look at Tommy Paul had match points against Nishikori. That would be an interesting one against Rafa, but I think it's a different animal.
Yeah, very, very different animal. So
Fognini's in that section, who's always dangerous.
Right. Well, Fognini's actually in the section slightly below, so he wouldn't play Fognini until the fourth round.
Yeah, fourth round.
Yeah, so Fognini should get through against Travaglia, assuming he shows up and bothers playing. Troiki, I would think. Well, actually, that's a tough one to call. But if we look at this next section, I don't know, that's an interesting one, actually. There's a couple interesting matchups, like Berdych-Harrison.
Harrison's going to have a shot there for sure.
Yeah, absolutely. But
Burdick, realistically, is probably bringing too much game.
Yes, probably a little too much sustained firepower. And you know, yeah. Burdick isn't exactly scintillating and creative, but he goes out and he hits the ball hard and through the court. And, you know, he's pretty consistent about the way that he goes about playing. And yeah, I think he's probably got a little too much of that for Harrison to handle.
If you're around in New York and that becomes a round three match, if you get to see Fognini and Berdych, that's a heck of a round three.
Yeah, that would be very exciting. That would be some exciting tennis.
Like that's going to be a heck of a match.
Yeah, agreed. And that looks like there's a very good chance that matchup will happen, looking at that little section. And then if we go down below that, it's Goffin, it's got Benatow, which I think he should get through that these days. You know, if this was 5 years ago, that might be a very different conversation. And then Monfils really should make it through his section as well. I think he's got enough in the tank for Shadi and Donald Young and Madara. So let's say they both get through. Who would you pick out of Monfils and Goffin?
I mean, these days, Monfils. You know, Goffin, I don't think is 100%. If you remember, he had that freak injury where he slipped on a tarp and messed up his ankle and his knee and his hip and stuff. I think he's rushing coming back to the tour a little bit, and he hasn't really been himself since he's come back. So to me, he's got a number 9 next to his name, and that's a little bit overrated right now. I would probably switch Monfils 18 and Goffin's 9, and I would probably reverse those.
Fair enough. So Dimitrov's got really a very friendly draw. I mean, I think if he doesn't get through to at least the third round, if not the fourth, then this will have to be a very disappointing slam for him, because his section is a sweetheart little portion here. I mean, he's got it set all the way through to the fourth round.
Yeah, the couple of guys that are interesting in his section to me, Andrei Rublev is playing Alaj Bedinay. Rublev is one of the next-gen guys. I don't think he's really ready to step up. I don't think he's got enough game at this point, but it's worth noting that he's there.
Right.
Bedinay is a guy who made a run, I think won a couple of very strong matches at Wimbledon this year. He does have game, and that's not going to be a gimme. I mean, if Dimitrov is on and if he's confident, then he's going to win it. But if he second-guesses himself there, then that can get really, really interesting. And then Cedric Marcel Stieb, or Stebe, I need to ask him how to pronounce his name. He's German. He's the qualifier.
Well, you know, Carl Ustieb back in the day, so probably it's Stieb, I'm going to guess.
Okay, we'll go with Stieb. So he's the qualifier who has basically come from not being on the tour to the top 100 in under a year, which means you are absolutely tearing things up. Yes. He's a lefty who basically never misses a ball. That could be very, very tough. If he's able to win a round and get through, then it's probably going to be Cuevas in a second. So anyway, what I will say is this. If Grigor is able to come through and, say, make the quarters, he's probably going to be playing really good ball.
Yeah, you know, the big danger for me is, I think, actually, is the match where he'll play either, realistically, Goffin or Monfils, because Monfils to me is the type of player who is a nightmare for Dimitrov, because
yes,
he's just so defensive and yet can come up with the goods, you know. So it's the thing to me is Monfils will let Dimitrov boss him around the court, but he's letting him do it, and then Monfils can pull the trigger and do something crazily explosive and athletic at the drop of a hat and turn the tables. You know,
right,
it's one thing for Dimitrov to have enough firepower, you know, to just beat someone off the court. But where he runs into trouble is those people that he can't quite just, you know, completely smack off the court. You know, with those people that can put a lot of balls in play, play very disciplined tennis, but he can't just power through them. And that's where he starts to make poor decisions. And Monfils the kind of guy who can just sucker him into making bad decisions, but then also come up with the goods when he needs to. So that's a dangerous matchup. I think, you know, if Goffin is really not 100%, he probably won't even make it that far. But that's a danger match for
Dimitrov. I could definitely see Monfils making the quarterfinals out of that section.
Yeah, I could too. I mean, I think Dimitrov's the favorite too. Yeah, I think Dimitrov's the likely one too. I just think that's a bad matchup. But if we move down to the next section, this one's got some heavy hitters in it. In fact, this is probably to me the most loaded section in the draw at the moment.
So well, it starts with Fed.
Yeah, Fed and Tiafo, which is, that's an interesting first round. I mean, and Fed should, you know, make his way through that pretty comfortably. Then, you know, he's playing either Yuzny or Kavcic. I'm not even going to try. I'm tired. It's late.
Kavcic. Before Kavcic. We move on to Kavcic, I just want to tell everybody, keep an eye out and watch that Federer match if you can. Francis Tiafoe is a young American who's not in on a wild card. He's in on his ranking, just for the record. he's mostly been a challenger player in the sense that he's won, I think, like four challengers in the last year. He's ranked somewhere in the 60s or 70s. But he's got a lot of game, and he's been sort of tipped as one of the next big guns. I mean, he's a next-gen player, and this is going to be your chance to see him up against the best of the best. So I can tell you right now, Francis is locked down, like focused. He thinks he's got a real chance to win this match. So he's not going out there just trying to win some games or, you know, look good.
Yeah,
it's going to be an interesting one to me.
I think he's wrong about that one. But, yeah, I mean, he's a very athletic guy. I just think there's a couple too many holes there, and Federer's pretty good at picking on people's holes. So I don't see that one, you know, turning out in his favor. But, you know, Federer's got a pretty good run through to the third round. This next little section is quite interesting because we've got Fernando Verdasco is playing Pospisil first up. And then Kuznetsov's got Feliciano Lopez. So Verdasco's not even seeded. Lopez is a 31 seed. But that's four pretty handy players in one little chunk.
Yeah, it is. I mean, you never know with Pospisil. So
you never know with Verdasco. Yeah, I mean, I still believe when Verdasco shows up, he's the best left-handed player in the world.
Just
for that whole part of the actual winning the match, you know.
Right.
But yeah, and then. Cole Schreiber, then it's funny, so we get that little section with four very solid players, and then we've got Cole Schreiber, Smicek, and then Milo and Giraldo. So
yeah, and if you take a quick note on that, Philip Cole Schreiber is the number 33 seed. You heard that correctly. That's the Andy Murray effect, right?
Yes, you don't see that every day.
There's a 33 seed instead of a 2 seed.
Yes, normally that would cap it at 32 seeds, and, exactly. And instead he gets to be... In fact, this might be the only time I think I've ever seen a 33 seed in a tournament, so hooray for Cole Schreiber. It's making history. I wonder if anybody knows if that's ever happened before in terms of the actual official seedings. But,
I don't know. Somebody needs a tweet shark, though.
Yeah, well, either way, I mean, I don't see any of those four guys really having a big impact deep in the tournament, so... you know, Kyrgios has a nice stretch. He's playing a fellow Aussie, Millman, in the first round.
And that's going to be a tough one.
Yeah. I think I could see him dropping a set there, assuming he's healthy and you know, doesn't have a Cincinnati hangover for any reason.
Well, Millman does not like to miss.
Right.
Kyrgios can certainly out-hit him, but that one's just got a lot of internal politics and... You know, they know each other very well. They've known each other for years. Millman's on the comeback trail after, I want to say, hip surgery in December or something like that. It's going to be interesting. I mean, they've certainly played together a lot. They know each other's games really well. They've been on the Davis Cup team together and whatnot.
Right. And so. there's a relatively large amount of pressure of Kyrgios. There's a lot of Kyrgios in that Kyrgios match. There's a fair amount of pressure on Kyrgios to playing a fellow Aussie in the first round off a big result in Cincinnati. You know, that's the kind of situation where I think we could see Nick maybe coming out not in the best psychological state. And when he comes out not in the best psychological state, anything can happen. So there could be some fireworks in that match, and that's definitely going to be one worth paying attention to. I mean, I think if Nick comes out and he's focused, that's a no-brainer, but there's a lot of things at play there that which may result in him being less than 100%. But if he's focused, he should come out of that section pretty comfortably, and I would think he would take care of the Cole Schreiber Smicek portion pretty handily. And
whoever wins that one, I think, is going to win. Win that next
yeah,
match.
Yeah, I mean, I think that gives Nick a good run through to the fourth round if he shows up and he's there. Entertaining tennis though in the section right below this, Seppi and Bautista Agut, and then Dustin Brown and Bellucci. So that should be some fun tennis for sure. But again, I think I don't see any one of those four guys really. I mean, Bautista Agut's probably obviously the favorite to come through that section, but I don't think any of those are going to have a massive impact on the tournament. Del Potro's coming up on us here. He also has a pretty relatively light section. And then we get towards the bottom, and you know, Thiem's got an... that has to be an Austrian, surely. De Minaur? No, he's Australian. Oh, my goodness. My bad.
Alex De Minaur. Come on, man. Yeah, it's the future of Australian tennis.
No, it's not.
No, really. He was the ITF junior number two. He's got the reciprocal wild card from Australia. He's 18 years old. He's top 200 in the world. So he's good. He is a good player. He's very, very smart. It's a terrible, terrible matchup for him to play Dominic. I'm not going to say why. But yeah, that one's going to be a tough one. But he's pushed some people and he's got a couple of big wins under his belt. I don't know if he can win in five sets over Team. I mean, if Team's bringing it, then his level is definitely higher. But
yeah, but that's an if. And I'll tell you, like, one thing that really stood out to me in Cincinnati was Team really was not making some good decisions on the hard courts. I was a little surprised, at, especially off the backhand wing, just how loose he was when he was playing Ferrer. I mean, he gifted up that match to Ferrer in a lot of ways. And, you know, I'm curious to see whether or not he comes out a little more disciplined here. I mean, the thing about Team is, I mean, he can out-hit most guys just on the cross court, you know, and especially right. David Ferrer. And yet he was going for a lot of down-the-line balls that were not really necessary and getting a lot of errors that way. So I'm curious to see if Team makes some adjustments. And
well, Damonar is the kind of guy that's not going to let you hit cross court all day. He's tricky. He's crafty.
Right.
He's a wise player well beyond his years. So that one's going to be interesting. I mean, that one's a popcorn match for me.
Yeah.
It really is.
Oh, yeah. No, it'd be a lot of fun to sit down and watch one way or the other. And then yeah. Baghdatis Fritz should be some. I mean, Baghdatis is always fun to watch.
Always a popcorn match. I love watching him. Play.
Yeah, it doesn't matter what. You know, that guy is. He just brings so much joy to the court when he plays. And he's so creative and aggressive and attacking. And I just. Yeah, there's a lot of enjoyment in watching Baghdatis out there.
You know, Fritz got a wild card here. He's had a little bit of an up and down year, but he's hitting the cover off the ball. He's been playing about as aggressively as possible, almost too much so over the past couple of months. So that one's going to be interesting to watch. Right above him is another fun American, Bjorn Fratangelo, drew the big serving Ivo Karlovic.
Yeah, does Fratangelo have a real shot at that?
Yeah, he does. He's got a good, solid, stable backhand return. He's got one of the most talented wrists on the tour. He's the young American who won the Junior French Open several years ago. I mean, he hits a heavy, heavy ball, but he's just a very competent, solid, all-around top 100 guy.
Yeah.
He's probably not going to have trouble holding serve. He's not going to be intimidated.
So lots of tiebreakers, in other words.
Probably lots of tiebreakers, yeah. I don't know who's going to win that one. Two of the nicest guys on tour right there squaring off against each other.
Yeah, I mean, I would think that the edge would go to Karlovic, but you never know. So let's jump down to the bottom half real quick and maybe speed up a little bit in the interest of time.
Okay, but, so first things first.
Yes.
If Sam Querrey keeps up his recent run of form, he could win this half. I'm just saying.
That's,
he could.
Yeah. I mean,
now,
you know, you're not – shockingly, you're not wrong. Yeah, I don't think that's likely.
It's not to me. But I wouldn't be surprised to see him in a quarter or a semi. And if you had told me that last year, I would have laughed at you.
Right. I mean, the flip side of that, though, is honestly, I mean, if Simon comes out and is healthy, I mean, I wouldn't be surprised to see him bounce out in the first round either. So that's kind of a tough one for Sam to open the tournament. You know, Simon's not a great matchup for him. I mean, I should say this. It's not a great matchup for him unless he's playing really well. If he's playing really well, that match could turn into target practice.
Exactly.
Yeah, he does club the ball, but that's the problem. You know, he clubs the ball, but he hasn't always traditionally done it with good decision-making. And Simon is really good at making people make poor decisions. You know, one thing I'm excited to see, Chris Eubanks in the match underneath that, especially as a Georgia Tech alum. You know,
I was going to say, that's your alma mater, right?
That's my alma mater. You better believe it, baby. So he's got Duty Seller, which, you know,
that's
I like
a tough
his,
one.
Yeah, it is a tough one, but I kind of like his chances, you know?
I like the matchup.
Yeah, I
so
did
for
too.
Those of you that don't know, Chris Eubanks is a college player, as in he is still in college.
Yes,
he got a wild card into the U.S. Open.
He's like 12 feet tall.
He's top 10 in college. He's slightly under 12 feet tall. I want to say he's about 6 foot seven. He's very fit. He's a hard worker. He's a smart kid under the tutelage of Kenny Thorne. Shout out to Kenny. He's a great guy. Chris is a great guy as well. Chris has a legitimately great serve. Of all the big guys, like the 6 foot seven guys and over, Chris, to me, has the best technique.
Right, yeah. His actual motion is, I mean.
Exactly.
Yeah, like, you know, Karlovic's, the output of Karlovic's serve is great, but when we look at the actual motion itself, and the same thing with Isner, I mean, there's a lot to be desired. If you were, you know, a normal size human being, if those guys were 6'1 or 6'2, you know, we wouldn't be talking about their serves at all. And
we wouldn't be talking about them as professional tennis players.
No, this is, yeah, exactly. That's precisely it.
But Chris has a nice motion. If Eubanks was 6'1", he'd still have a really good serve. It just wouldn't be
as good.
As good.
Yeah.
So I like the matchup because I think if Eubanks really was smart, he could probably hit kick serves over Doody's head the whole day and force Doody to go to this chip and the slice. The thing is, you know, Doody's just a really smart player. These quick courts actually help his game. So it makes it easier for Doody to hold serve and for Doody to hurt his opponent.
Doody's 5'9", by the way, for people listening. So he's almost a foot shorter, yeah.
Doody's actually is a foot shorter. I don't know what he's listed at, but I'm going to say there's no way that Doody's 5'8".
Okay, he's listed as 5'9". Let me rephrase that, yeah.
Yeah. So. Eubanks is a legitimate 6'7", and Doody's a legitimate 5'7".
Yeah.
There's a great picture out there with Doody Sela like standing on a chair with Ivo Karlovic. It's going to be pretty close to the same thing.
Yeah, yeah.
And Doody can beat big servers. He likes big servers. If Chris is smart, he's not going to serve flat big the way that Karlovic does. He's going to serve like a pitcher.
Right.
And that would be great.
Get some movement on that.
Either way, he's got a great future ahead of him. That one's going to be fun. If you can find it, I'd say watch it.
Yeah. So let's just skip ahead a little bit. Misha Zverev, seeded 23. I mean, how exciting for him, you know, coming back from all the injuries and the history that he's had and his younger brother having such success. And now here he is, seeded 23 at the U.S. Open as a serve volleyer at the ripe old age of, wait, how old is he now? He's ripe old age of 30. Actually, yeah. His birthday was just a few days ago. So that's really exciting. And he's got a pretty good crowd to get out of his section. Lucas Lacco and Benoit Paire are in the other little part of his section. And, I think he should be good for that to get through.
I'm really interested in watching Zabaios and Chung. Chung is the young Korean who's battled some injuries of late, but he's one of the best guys on the tour from the ground.
Yeah, he's so good.
And, you know, yeah, that's going to be an interesting one against Zabaios. I mean, Zabaios just fights his butt off, but if Chung is on his game, he's going to have too much for him. And then two big servers with Isner and Pierre-Hugues Herbert.
Mm-hmm.
And that one's going to be really interesting. A lot of guys serving big and coming to the net there.
Yeah, absolutely. It's a little attacking section and a couple of base runners on the other one. If we jump forward, Tomic and Mueller. And is Tomic going to bother putting an effort in?
Tomic has been working. I've seen him in the gym. The problem is that... you know, he didn't go to the gym for a long time, and so I'm not sure that he really knows what to do when he's there.
Right, and also he's playing catch-up.
Yeah, I'm not saying that as a cynical jerk. I mean that seriously. Like, I really don't think he knows what to do. So, he's really struggling, man. His ranking has taken a huge dive.
Yeah.
And
so is his popularity along with that.
He's still a nice guy. He still treats human beings well. As long as they're not named Bernard Tomic, I think he treats himself probably worse than anyone else.
Yeah, fair enough. That's a bad matchup. Mueller's a bad matchup for Tomic because Mueller's just such a nuts and bolts. He's got a very simple game. He's not at all confused about his identity as a player. He knows what side of the bread he's buttered on, and he's going to go out there and hit amazing serves and come forward and take time away. And, you know, Tomic, a lot of what Tomic does is just make tennis awkward for people. And, you know, there's a little bit of rope-a-dope going. And Mueller's just not going to let him do that. So
one thing I'll say is if Mueller doesn't do his homework here and underestimates Tomic. Mueller traditionally serves a lot of balls out wide on the ad side. Like, we're talking 70% of serves out wide on the ad side. And Tomic's backhand return is still one of the best in the game. So that's where, if Mueller's going to have trouble, that's where it's going to be. It's going to be with just not having prepared right and not choosing the right serves.
Yeah, but you know, the thing to me is, the downside is Mueller's, I mean, Tomic has to come out and just make shots. And that could be interesting, you know, if Tomic is like there, if he's engaged. That's not going to be, I think, a hugely physically taxing match for Tomic. But, you know, has he put in the work to come out and make, you know, 58 passing shots is a big question. And then, yeah, there's not really any other, I think, to me, any particularly interesting matches remaining down there.
Sock and Thompson. Sock
up higher. I mean, I just kind of jumped over that one. But
yeah, Sock and Thompson is going to be a really interesting one to see who gets through that. I'd keep an eye on that. What else? I mean, JC Aragon has gone from playing like middle lineup on his college team to qualifying for the U.S. Open in his first year. We really don't know how good he is. That one's going to be fascinating.
Yeah, and Kevin Anderson seems to be kind of getting it back together again. He was really playing some great ball there for a while, and then not for a while, and now he's getting it together again, as I already said. So that should be fun.
If we skip farther down, Shapovalov and Medvedev, a couple of next-gen players. Shapovalov came through qualifying, even though he's now ranked in the top 70 after his Lightning run. Because of when the entry deadline was. Yep. So, but good on him to be able to come through qualifications comfortably enough, I should say.
Yeah, absolutely.
I mean, that's a tough one. It would have been easy for him to throw in the towel there and feel like he was shafted.
No, for sure. And then Almagro and Johnson, that should be there's going to be some hard hit tennis balls on that match.
Yeah, man.
I mean, good we might be able to hear that from Atlanta.
I would expect Stevie J to get through that one. But it's going to be good tennis. I mean, it's certainly no gimme.
Yeah, I mean, if this was Almagro from 5 years ago, it might be a different story, but it's not, and so it isn't. So I think you're right on that one. I'm just kind of scanning down the rest here, and this is really...
I would probably skip down to Lucas Pouillet and Ruben Bellman.
At least that far. This is where the quarter just gets kind of very underwhelming as a whole.
Well, you know, the one thing that's going to be interesting down here to me, Pouillet, remember, has been, you know, a top 20 player, and he's played really well. And some people thought he was going to break out and be a top 10 guy just a couple of months ago. So he has a nice little opportunity here to go deep. But right below him, Gerald Donaldson plays Basilashvili. There's like seven names on the tour I really struggle with, and that's one of them. Anyway, Donaldson is actually the best American returner. Craig O'Shancy wrote an article specifically about that over the last week or two. You should Google it if you haven't already given it a read. But Donaldson has really big game from the ground. He's very steady off both sides. He's really good. He's a guy that we've tabbed to be one of the first top 50 Americans in that young next generation, you know, under 21 age group. And it's not out of the question for him to win his first round and then win his second round and then be the favorite in the third round and all of a sudden find himself in the round of 16.
In that section, that's certainly very doable. Because
in that section, it's doable.
I mean, whoever's going to get through to the fourth round here is going to have to go through David Ferrer to do it. And that's a tough ask.
He's got the kind of game that could give Ferrer a lot of problems. He's got a great return. He's got a big first serve. And his backhand is 20 times better than Ferrer's. And I'm not exaggerating. I mean, his backhand's one of the best on the tour.
Right.
He doesn't have Ferrer's forehand. I'm not crazy. But you got to give credit where credit's due. And the guy poses some pretty severe matchup problems for most of these players here. So,
sure.
You know, we'll see how the young American steps up. We've got Kokkinakis down there in the bottom of the draw. I mean, he recently made his first ATP final, I think.
Yeah, very excited to see him back. You know, obviously he had some time off with the injury.
Injuries, plural.
Injuries, well, yeah, injuries, plural.
Australian kid, super nice guy, big game, big
yeah,
big
he
server,
was
big
he was
forehand.
You know doing quite well overall, and then got hurt, and yeah, you're absolutely right. Like he just made the final at Los Cabos in Mexico and lost to Mr. Query just a couple of weeks ago, and so that's good to see him back. You know, it's got an exciting game.
Besides that, I hesitate to make any kind of predictions about Cilic because we hear these rumors that his health isn't right either and that he's not fully healthy. So,
right.
You know,
and
big
Tennis
guy
Sagrin,
like that,
you know, is a very solid player.
Tennis Sagrin's got a lot of heart. He can grind with the best of them. So, you know, he's another one of those guys who would literally do damage to himself in order to win a round.
Right. And, you know, for Cilic, especially early in the tournament, that could be a very dangerous matchup because, you know, if Cilic comes out and he's a little off early and Sagrin just makes a lot of balls and extends a lot of rallies and makes him fight, that could turn ugly.
Cilic has been known to lose a sneaky first round here or there. Let's just put it that way.
Yeah, and this could be a very sneaky first round for him. So, you know, we didn't quite touch on every match. Maybe we touched on too many of them. I don't know. If you think so, let us know. Love to hear from you folks either way. You can reach me at Glenn with one N, GLEN at tacticaltennis.com.
I'm Jacob at tacticaltennis.com.
And we should hopefully be pumping out some throughout the tournament here and getting some more robust predictions as we get some rounds and some tennis in, you know, because there's always that question of how the courts are going to play exactly. And, you know, we've seen so many people pull out injured before the tournament's even started. There's always a wonder of how many people are coming in with some level of injury that they're kind of going to play it by ear and see how well. But, you know, realistically, I mean, talking, you know, not just like the minor niggling stuff, but really just how many people are carrying something substantial, reasonably substantial, and they really are just waiting to see how it goes. So once we get through a round or two and we start to get an idea of what's going on with people, we'll be able to talk about some of these matchups a little more. And also, there'll just be a lot less matches to talk about, which helps. Also, before we sign off, I do just want to take a moment and acknowledge the fact that there is a scenario. Well, let me just run through this. If, on the women's side, if Simona Halep loses in her first round and Muguruza loses before the fourth round, and Svitolina loses before the semis, and Pliskova loses before the final, and Venus Williams wins, she becomes world number one for the first time since 2002. So,
can I cheer for all of those things just on principle?
I mean, how amazing would it be to see Venus come back and make number one, given everything that she's been through? She is by far my favorite Williams sister. And, you know, I'm happy that she's still out there. I'm happy that she's still fighting. I'm happy to see her healthy. And, you know, I wouldn't wish those losses on any of those other ladies, but it would be kind of awesome to see Venus come through and win it all and take number one.
If all of that happens and if Venus ends this tournament as being number one, or if she ever gets to number one in the world, then it will have been meant to be. I mean, that's just such a, like, crazy scenario,
right?
I would have no complaints if that happens. Then it's just like, okay, it's too good.
Yeah,
it's,
but so just really quickly, and I'm just borrowing some information here from the folks over at lastwordontennis.com really quickly, because they have a nice little summary of all of this stuff, and I thought it was interesting. You know, Halep has to play Sharapova in the first round.
That's
actually possible. Muguruza has a horrible record at the US Open as a whole. So, you know, and then Pliskova has both Kerber and Ostapenko in her half of the draw.
That's brutal.
Yeah, so, you know, it's actually not out of the question. It's actually somehow not out of the question that this might come to pass. So we'll see what happens, but just worth keeping an eye on there, folks. And of course, we've got to see Serena. We've got to see Venus play well. That's an important piece of that puzzle. But she's on tomorrow, third match on Arthur Ashe Stadium in the morning. Well, it'll be afternoon by the time she starts. But either way, should be some fun tennis to be seen.
Absolutely.
So, all right, folks, reach out. Outside of that, love to hear from you all. Have a great day.
Have a great night, guys.